Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 16, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi rights activists march against the conflict in Gaza.
We see a lot of children are suffering, a lot of women are suffering. So as a human being, I can be happy if soldiers, they can shoot soldier to soldier, send to kill children.
Meanwhile, the families of the nearly 240 hostages have begun a five-day march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to demand their relief. DRC opposition candidates meet in South Africa to discuss a possible unified candidate. We'll have a reaction. Rwanda is disappointed in the UK Supreme Court decision on migrant resettlement. Liberia's Elections Commission releases runoff preliminary results.
Walker Joseph N., UP, votes obtained 193,041. Wia George Manning, CDC, votes obtained 187,615.
And South Sudan's transitional government is set to deploy the first phase of the unified forces. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Malawi, rights activists and leaders from various religious groups organized a march on Wednesday to call for an immediate ceasefire in the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Some of the hundreds of people who participated in the street march carried placards and banners condemning the conflict in Gaza and appealed for peace to return to the enclave. This is the first time religious leaders in Malawi have marched against a conflict happening nearly 5,000 kilometers away from home. Shaib Abdurrahman Ajas is the chairperson for the Forum for Democracy and Rights Defenders, which organized the march. He says we could not have just sat down here in Malawi and watched what is happening in Gaza while other countries across the world are speaking against the conflict. He says that's why we here in Malawi said no, enough is enough, and we too should stand up and speak against what is happening in Gaza. Ajas said the concern is the killing of innocent people. Palestinian authorities in Gaza says more than 11,000 people, about 40% of them children, have been killed since Israel launched a major air and ground offensive in response to the October 7 attack by Hamas on southern Israel that left 1,200 people dead. About 240 people were kidnapped and are currently being hosted by Hamas in Gaza. The Israel military said Wednesday that its troops raided Gaza's Shifa Hospital, a complex of buildings where thousands of people have sheltered. Israel has accused Hamas, which controls Gaza, of using the hospital and its patients as human shields for command centers and safe houses. But Hamas and hospital officials deny the accusations. Bishop Joshua Jere is the president of the Pastors Peacemakers Fraternal, a grouping of Christian religious leaders in Malawi.
We see a lot of children are suffering, a lot of women are suffering. So as a human being, I can be happy if soldiers, they can shoot soldier to soldier, send to kill children or women or innocent people. So it's my prayer. I believe in this.
Sheikh Muslim Abbas Vinjenje is the Secretary General for the Ulama Council of Malawi, a group of Muslim scholars. He said what is happening in Gaza is tantamount to war crimes.
Our main expectation is for ceasefire in Gaza, and that Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the Prime Minister of Israel, should be taken to International Criminal Court to be investigated for war crimes and genocide, which him and his army commanders have conducted to the people of Gaza.
The top UN human rights official said last week the atrocities that Hamas fighters committed in Israel on October 7 also amounted to war crimes. Ajas, who organized the Wednesday's march in Blantyre, said the Forum for Democracy and Rights Defenders will organize another march in the capital Lilongwe in 2 weeks' time should the conflict and killing of innocent people continue. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The families of the nearly 240 hostages Hamas is believed to be holding in Gaza have begun a five-day march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. They say they want the government to do more to win the freedom of their loved ones. Linda Gristin reports from Tel Aviv.
It has been weeks of agony for the families of the hostages, weeks with no news about whether their loved ones are alive. Now they are marching to Jerusalem. Yuval Aran survived the massacre at Kibbutz Be'eri, but seven members of his family, including three children, were taken hostage by Hamas.
I always worry. I'm always in pain, and I can't sit at home anymore. I have to do something, and this march is what I am going to do with all the families of the hostages and this entire country.
Shaul Levy's granddaughter, Na'ama, was seen being kidnapped in one of the first videos posted by Hamas on social media networks. Levy says he is marching to deliver a message to the government.
We start here in this museum in Tel Aviv, walking to Jerusalem, hoping to meet the government, hoping the prime minister, to emphasize that there is no any alternative, only to bring them all back home.
The Hostage and Missing Families Forum advocacy group has demanded urgent attention be paid to the needs of more than 30 children taken hostage without their parents. They believe that one woman may even have given birth in captivity.
I am demanding from Benjamin Netanyahu and from all the cabinet to give us answers and deeds. We have no strength anymore. Bring back our children and bring our families home.
Israel believes that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are holding hostages in tunnels below buildings in Gaza, including hospitals, accusations Hamas and hospital officials deny. Israel's army spokesman shows a tunnel leading to what he says is a maze of underground rooms below the Rantisi Children's Hospital in northern Gaza.
You're now entering into the room where we suspect the hostages were being held. I want you to look at this room. People are putting curtains with nothing above, just wall. No reason to put here a curtain unless you want to film hostages and deliver movies.
The U.S.-designated terrorist groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad have posted videos on their social media channels of hostages making statements which Israeli analysts believe are coerced. A new video post shows a Hamas spokesman saying that the group is willing to release up to 70 hostages, apparently women, children, and the elderly, in exchange for a five-day ceasefire and the release of women and minors serving time in Israeli jails.
The truce should include a ceasefire and allowing aid relief, everything in Gaza Strip. But the enemy is procrastinating and evading to pay the price of the deal.
Israeli officials say they worry that a five-day ceasefire will allow Hamas to rearm and continue to fight Israel. They also say there will be heavy international pressure to continue the ceasefire. The families of the hostages worry that time is running out for their loved ones, and they say they hope that their march will continue to focus Israeli and world attention on the plight of the hostages and intensify efforts to secure their release. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Tel Aviv.
Former Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai of the Opposition Unity Party has taken a slim early lead in the first provisional results from Tuesday's runoff election. Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia, Liberia.
According to the Constitution, the declaration of winners of an election should be done within 15 days after voting. Announcing the first results, National Elections Commission Chairperson Divieto Brun-Lansana said former Vice President Joseph Boakai of the Unity Party, UP, has 50.71% and incumbent President George Weah of the CDC Party accumulated 49.29%, constituting 22.33% out of the total votes.
Boka Joseph N, UP, votes obtained 193,041, constituting 50.71%. Weah George Money, CDC, votes obtained 187,615, constituting 49.29%.
From the provisional results, Bwaka leads with a difference of 5,426 votes, with over 77% votes still left to be counted. Prior to the reading of the results, Bwaka supporters led by Monserrate County Representative Yeke Koluba took to the streets, chanting that their candidate had won the election.
For making former President George Manuel Weah a one-term president, we also want to recognize President Ambassador Joseph Yuma Bwaka. We also want to recognize Vice President Jeremiah Banku. Let me say to the Liberian people, the celebration has started.
Claiming an early victory has raised concerns among some Liberians like Aliyu Cisse. He says he wants peace in the country.
I think the process of voting was really peaceful in accordance with the laws. All I do expect is the peace that we need, nothing else but the peace.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, in a statement released on Wednesday, warned individuals or groups against doing anything that could lead to violence and undermine the hard-earned stability of Liberia. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsey in Monrovia, Liberia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 16. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A presidential candidate in the Democratic Republic of Congo says other opposition candidates meeting outside of the country to discuss a unity candidate for December's election should be disqualified from running. Noel Chiani, leader of the political group called Force for Change, says any candidate chosen outside of DRC is not nationalistic enough and would be controlled by foreign interests. According to Reuters, opposition candidate Martin Fayulu, Denis Mukwege, and Moi Katumbi have been meeting this week in South Africa to decide on a potential unity candidate to challenge President Felix Tshisekedi in the December 20 polls. Chiani tells me that any candidate chosen outside of DRC would only be a puppet of foreign countries and companies.
I will not go to South Africa. I will not go to a foreign country. DRC is an independent and sovereign state. How can a presidential candidate go and meet in a foreign country on the invitation of foreign companies or NGOs or governments? In my view, those kind of leaders, they don't know what they are doing and they should not be running for president of the Congo.
What do you make of the whole idea of a unity candidate?
Well, the idea of a unity candidate who the nationalist who meets the criteria to be president of the Congo, the idea is not bad. But a unity candidate sponsored by foreign countries, foreign companies, foreign NGOs, in my view, it's a big dilemma because such a candidate cannot be loyal to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Instead, it will be a puppet candidate working for foreign countries and looting the natural resources of the Congo to pay his foreign sponsors. So in my view, that's a terrible idea. Imagine the United States of America, for example, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party going to meet in Russia to nominate their candidate for the presidency. Can you imagine that? Those people should be disqualified immediately. They don't deserve to be considered in the Congo by the people of the Congo.
But don't you think you are taking this issue too far? I mean, what's wrong with meeting in another country to discuss issues of your country? It's not that the foreign country is going to influence the decision. It seems you're taking it too far.
I know how it works. I am just asking you, don't ask the Congolese to accept the things that Americans cannot accept for their countries. Can the Democratic Party or the Republican Party going to meet in Russia or in China to nominate their candidate for president, is that acceptable? If it is not acceptable for the Americans, what is happening here should not be acceptable to the Congolese. And I disapprove it, because any candidate coming out under those conditions can only be a puppet of foreign countries, foreign companies, and he cannot defend the interest of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That will be, as a matter of fact, contrary to the Chinese law, which requires people at that level to be loyal to the Democratic Republic of the Congo and its people.
So what do you think about the idea, the whole idea of the opposition coming up with a unified candidate for the December election?
It depends on how it is done. If it is done in the Congo, with all the candidates from the opposition participating, starting by elaborating the criteria which will be transparent to nominate that representative of the opposition, and those criteria should be very clear.
According to Mr. Fayulu, one of the candidates, the opposition leaders meeting South Africa are also supposed to discuss the transparency of the election. They want to make sure that the December election are transparent. Do you agree with that?
Well, I keep repeating the same thing. Why should such a meeting take place in South Africa or in a foreign country?
Noel Shiani is the leader of the Forces for Change political grouping in the DRC and a presidential candidate. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. Rwanda has expressed disappointment in the ruling Wednesday of the United Kingdom Supreme Court that the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda was unlawful because Rwanda could not be considered a safe third country. In a statement on social media, government spokesperson Yolande Makolo said Rwanda and the UK have been working together to ensure the integration of relocated asylum seekers into Rwandan society and that the country remains committed to its international obligations. Gatete Nyirigambo is a human rights lawyer and political blogger in Kigali. He tells me that Rwanda is only trying to provide a haven to migrants now wanted by the UK.
The Rwandan government is not pleased with the decision because the ruling appears as though it was Rwanda that was on trial. I mean, if the UK wants to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, if they don't, that's fine. But the question is, when you look at the ruling, it is a ruling that talks about Rwandan human rights record, Rwandan this, Rwandan that, and in fact, half of it Rwandans do not even agree with. So they're wondering how come, instead of having a debate about the United Kingdom, a rich country in Europe, deciding to deport black people and other people, is that lawful? Is that in line with the human rights, international law, and so on and so forth? So Rwandans are shocked about this.
I think part of the ruling is that Rwanda is not a safe country for asylum seekers and refugees.
But whether Rwanda is safe, is unsafe, is a secondary question. People are avoiding the main question. What Rwanda did was avail itself. It's like someone who's homeless, you give them a house, and then they start criticizing the quality of the house that you give them. The idea is, why are asylum seekers being sacked from the United Kingdom in the first place? Because that's a violation of international law. Now, we can discuss the quality of asylum seekers in Rwanda. You have asylum seekers who have a good life in Rwanda, you have others who don't. And that is a fair discussion to have. But the main question really is, why is it that the UK, in total violation of decency, why is the UK chasing its own migrants who found its shore? I mean, Africans are rightfully angry because they say if we wanted to go to Rwanda, we'd have taken a plane and go to Rwanda. We know where Rwanda is. It's much cheaper, it's much safer to travel there than to go to the Mediterranean Sea and to go through boats at the risk peril of our life.
You have written that the issue is a fundamental ideological question. What is the ideology?
The ideological question is human beings fleeing conflict of all kinds, finding the United Kingdom as a safe haven. But the United Kingdom, a rich country, is much, much bigger than Rwanda, decides to get rid of people who try to find safe haven in the country, and the poor African, small poor African country says, instead of mistreating those people, send them to us, we'll take care of them. And this is the same UK that does not stop from teaching us about moral values, about human rights, about this and that. And so the ideological question at stake here is, how does a poor country show more humanity than a rich country that claims to be the guarantor of human rights and human values and so on? So the UK are criticizing Rwanda to avoid the big question.
Got it. Yiri Ngabo is a human rights lawyer and political blogger. He was speaking with us from Kigali, Rwanda. South Sudan's transitional government of national unity is set to deploy the first phase of the necessary unified forces to the Upper Nile capital, Malakal, this week. According to the 2018 revitalized peace agreement, South Sudan is supposed to graduate a total of 83,000 unified forces, including police, army, and intelligence units, to take charge of the country's security. VOA's John Tanza spoke with South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui.
Today in Luri, the unified force, which we have been longing for all this time, yes, this morning was deployed because it was graduated last August, and they have been deployed today, and it is the first battalion of the unified forces that has been deployed today, and they have been given all the requirements, and they have been moved to the transport destination that is to the riverside, so that they bought the boats. So they are now on their way to Malakal, which is the first destination in which the unified force is deployed.
And
he was mentioning that this force was a combination of forces from the three regions. One, forces from Upper Nile, from Equatoria, and from Bahr Ghazal have been mixed up, unified, and sent now. The same thing, they are now in the process of preparing another battalion that will be going also to Bahr al-Ghazal, and another battalion that will be here in Equatoria. So that is the process, and we have now started the deployment of these forces so that we give room to phase two of the forces to enter the training center.
Correct. From the information I'm getting in Juba, that the troops in Luri were totaling to around 800, did not have guns. How do you deploy troops without guns?
Well, this is what the international community wants, because we have been demanding the lifting of arms embargo so that we deploy them with guns. Instead, the international community had been on our neck and demanding that we deploy them. And we have been saying, how do we deploy forces without guns? And they said they ought to be deployed. And so we have done it. Now the international community will tell us as to what are these forces going to do without arms.
Yes, Mr. Minister, the revitalized peace agreement stipulates clearly that these unified forces are going to be in charge of security in major towns of South Sudan, or if you like, state capitals of the 10 state plus the three administrative areas. If you are starting phase one, deploying them without guns, how are they going to provide security in those areas, especially Malakal, that's been a hotspot?
Yes, it is true. And this is what we know. And this is why we have been delaying the deployment, hoping that the arms embargo will be lifted so that we arm them. But with the international community on our neck, saying that you must deploy them, you have delayed in the implementation of the security arrangement. You are obstructing the implementation of the agreement. So we had to deploy them so that they see it for themselves, that these forces are now going for deployment without arms.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui was speaking with VOA's John Tanza. And that's it for this Thursday, November 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.